From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Daniel Levitin was a record producer, a sound engineer, an agent for Columbia Records. Now he's a neuroscientist, and he still can't get the music out of his head. Neither can we. Beethoven, Beatles, Broadway tunes, Shakira, Stevie Wonder. The music plays, and we listen, and often love it. But why? This hour On Point, we're talking about music on the brain with neuroscientist Daniel Levitin. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for a neuroscientist to untangle the mystery of music? Can science really explain this love affair? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And thank you, Stevie Wonder. Joining me from Vancouver, Canada, is Daniel Levitin. He's associate professor in the Department of Psychology, Neuroscience, and Music at McGill University in Montreal. He's out with a new book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. Daniel Levitin, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to meet you.
So here you were in the music business, and you end up in the science business. What's the bridge?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think that science is not just a business but a way of looking at the world. It's people who have a kind of scientific bent look around them and they ask themselves, why are things this way? How does the engine under the hood work? Things like that. And so a lot of people that I knew in the music business and in the performing arts have a very curious nature and wonder about how things come to be the way they are. And I was the same, and I found that when I was working in studios, I spent a lot of time asking questions about how does this piece of gear work, or why is this musician better than this one? Mm. What's going on in his brain that might have made him that way? And I just pursued my interests by reading a lot and taking classes.
And now you're way in deep. I mean, you remind us of how many things have been mysteries that now are less mysterious. In the last couple of years, all the insights into the fabric of space-time, the constitution of matter, the many forms of energy, the origins of the universe, the nature of life and DNA. What are we learning about music?
Music is a very complicated activity. It involves virtually every part of the brain that we've mapped and that we know about. And what we're learning is that it's as old in our species as anything else that we have on the historical record.
It's got antiquity and it's got ubiquity. You're taking us into the brain here to see how the whole thing really works when the sound hits that physical mass inside our skulls. You've got a wonderful description on it in your book, This Is Your Brain on Music. I wonder if you might read for us, Daniel. If you could set us up, you began to go in and track. You play the music and track the brain. You've got an almost ecstatic scientific explanation here of music hitting that brain. Set us up for us and read a bit.
Well, what's happening in the brain is that all of our sensory receptors get what are essentially ambiguous signals or information about what's out there in the world, and the brain has to put it together. One of the ways that we know it's ambiguous is through visual or auditory illusions. Many of us have seen these visual illusions where you have the two lines that seem to be parallel but they're not, mm-hmm. or one line seems to be longer than another but they're the same. And illusions like this show us that the brain is sometimes making mistakes about how it interprets the world and reveal that in many cases the brain is just guessing. It's using a statistical map of what it thinks is going on and takes a best guess. It does this so seamlessly, and it updates its estimates when it's wrong so rapidly that we usually don't know that that's what's going on.
So you wired up the brain, and here you report on what you found. I'd love to just hear you share it with us.
Well, we now have the technology, Tom, where we can take pictures of the brain as it's thinking. Neuroimaging and fMRI experiments allow us to figure out which parts of the brain are active when we're doing certain activities, such as listening to music or performing math calculations. And in the passage I'm going to read you from the book, my colleagues and I had done a number of studies already and figured out where in the brain a lot of musical processing is happening.
Let's hear it. It's great stuff. We want to hear it.
So, particularly when we're enjoying the music, what we hadn't been able to pin down is the actual time course of when things are happening in the brain, and that's where I'll pick up the story here on page 187.
Wonderful.
We found exactly what we had hoped. Listening to music caused a cascade of brain regions to become activated in a particular order, First, auditory cortex for initial processing of the components of the sound. Then the frontal regions, such as Brodmann Area 44 and 47, that we'd previously identified as being involved in processing musical structure and expectations. Finally, a network of regions, the mesolimbic system, involved in arousal, pleasure, and the transmission of opioids and the production of dopamine, culminating in activation in the nucleus accumbens. And the cerebellum and basal ganglia were active throughout music listening, presumably supporting the processing of rhythm and meter. The rewarding and reinforcing aspects of listening to music seem, then, to be mediated by increasing dopamine levels in the nucleus accumbens, and by the cerebellum's contribution to regulating emotion through its connections to the frontal lobe and the limbic system. Current neuropsychological theories associate positive mood and affect with increased dopamine levels, one of the reasons that many of the newer antidepressants act on the dopaminergic system. Music is clearly a means for improving people's moods. Now we think we know why. I think one of the interesting things if you don't remember your brain anatomy from introductory freshman neuroscience, is that the cerebellum.
We hardly need to. I mean, you got us so excited there with mesolimbics and cerebellum and basal ganglia and opioids and dopamine. I mean, I just love the way you lay that out, and you go right from that to talking about how music has some features of language that are picked up on by the brain, but also there's this issue of expectation and counter-expectation.
Did you want me to continue on?
I'd love it if you'd share it. I think it's terrific.
Music appears to mimic some of the features of language and to convey some of the same emotions that vocal communication does, but in a non-referential and non-specific way. It also invokes some of the same neural regions that language does, but far more than language, music taps into primitive brain structures involved with motivation, reward, and emotion. Whether it is the first few hits of the cowbell in Honky Tonk Women, or the first few notes of Scheherazade, computational systems in the brain synchronize neural oscillators with the pulse of the music and begin to predict when the next strong beat will occur. As the music unfolds, the brain constantly updates its estimates of when new beats will occur and takes satisfaction in matching a mental beat with a real in-the-world one, and takes delight when a skillful musician violates that expectation in an interesting way, a sort of musical joke that we're all in on. Music breathes, speeds up, and slows down, just as the real world does, and our cerebellum finds pleasure in adjusting itself to stay synchronized.
Daniel Levitin, let's take it straight to the tunes. There's one you point to, Jackie Brenson and the Delta Cats with Rocket 88, 1951. Let's listen to just a little bit of that.
Jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight.
Okay, Daniel, I'm jiving. What's going on?
Well, this is argued by many to be the first rock and roll song, and although that might be an overstated claim, it has a lot of the elements of rock and roll, and this is 1951. I think that this is one of the first instances of a song about a car, which is, of course, a great rock theme. It's about his Oldsmobile. There's this sort of sexual overtone, the Rocket 88 idea. And this became, I think, the blueprint for a lot of rock and roll that came later.
But why is my brain so happy? I mean, I get the sort of, I get the lyrics, but what's happening underneath there, under the hood, as you say?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on. First, you know, the performer himself, Jackie Brenson, is, you know, clearly joyful and having a good time, and that's infectious. We pick up on that ebullience. And I think the other thing is that the chord progression, what we call the 1-4-5 progression, which is the backbone of rock music and rhythm and blues, is just a very powerful and primal kind of a chord progression. It's got a lot of motion to it, intrinsic to the chord progression.
No kidding. Let's listen to how others picked up on it, right from Jackie through Chuck Berry, the Beach Boys, and the Beatles.
You women have haven't heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Sweet little 16, she just got to have about a half a million famed autographs.
All over the hall, inside, outside, at Wyandotte Bay, inside, outside, everybody's gone surfing
USA.
Leave the West behind, and my little girls make me sing and shout.
And there we go. Maybe your basal ganglia is going now. Daniel Levitin, we're going to come back and look at a lot more music and the connections between how our brain is absorbing this, what's going on the drum pad, on the guitar. What with Steely Dan with a piece where, well, just hear the human voice echoed here, and if your brain's not picking up voice tones, I don't know what it is picking up. Daniel Levitin's new book is This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. You can join us. Do you know what makes you love what you love in music? And how do you think you listen, with your heart or your brain? Is there a difference? Is making music brain surgery? After all, 800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from
la, 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 la.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about music and the brain with neuroscientist Daniel Levitin. His new book is This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. You can join our conversation. You there with the earbuds and the big stereo. Why is it that music is so important to our species? Do you agree with Daniel Levitin that we are obsessed? And if it's all about neuroscience, why aren't computers the best composers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Daniel Levitin, here's Neil Young, of course, with Will to Live. I was asking half facetiously whether we listen with our heart or our brain. It is a very emotional song. We think of that as something about the heart. Of course, this whole poetic idea of the heart's kind of being defined out of existence by science. What's the neuroscience of emotion in music, at least at this direct level?
We know at the neuroscientific level that music is engaging the same emotional circuitry that's engaged when we have deeply emotional experiences of other kinds, eating chocolate, having an orgasm, taking cocaine or opium. These reward centers in the brain are also active when we listen to pleasurable music. Now, why that is so, we don't really know, but it may be that it's because music... the poetic answer, as Tori Amos says, is that music is the language of the universe. I think the neuroscientific answer is that music may mimic some aspects of early language. By early, I mean early in our species.
Mm-hmm.
Mothers talking to their infants, and the kind of pitch contours of mothers cooing and comforting children.
And what
or lovers, mm-hmm. Lovers fighting or... whatever, you know,
lovers do.
Men out on the hunt and trying to get themselves motivated to go out and kill some animals.
And what about the centrality of it? I mean, is it only the human brain that's so enchanted by it? And why so enchanted? We were joking at the top of the show, you know, we understand the urge to sex, the urge to food. There's a direct, obvious reason for music. On the face of it, would seem optional, and yet everywhere that there are humans, there's so much music, there's something. I mean, that brain really wants it.
Well, you mentioned the antiquity and the ubiquity, and I think that's an important clue. Some of the oldest artifacts that we've found in human burial sites and archaeological digs are musical instruments. In fact, we haven't found anything older than bone flutes. Music seems to have been with the species a very long time, and we don't know of any culture now or any time in the past that lacked music. So, Steven Pinker, the cognitive psychologist at Harvard, has said that music is an evolutionary accident, piggybacking on language. Mm. He calls it auditory cheesecake, the analogy being that although we didn't, although we enjoyed cheesecake, it wasn't an evolutionary adaptation. Whatever mechanisms we have evolved to help us find nourishing food get somehow tricked by cheesecake.
I have a question on that front, though. People talk about, playing Mozart for the baby to pump up the IQ, and even full-grown adults putting on some music because the brain loves to play in this realm. I've always wondered if there's a kind of chicken and egg dynamic here. I mean, did our intelligence permit us to enjoy music, or has music actually helped build human intelligence?
Well, that's a great point, and I think there is a theory a prominent theory about the role of music in evolution, which is that, as you say, music did help to build cognitive flexibility and to train our brains in order to prepare them for language and for complex social interactions. A lot of music performance involves turn-taking or synchronization, very social activities. Improvising or playing music, composing music typically involves taking a theme and varying it, which is a form of cognitive flexibility. That cognitive flexibility would be useful when you're trying to find a source of water or food out on the savanna and the one that you knew about had dried up.
So there you've got music as a kind of game that mimics life and yet can provide all kinds of surprises. Maybe the first virtual reality. We've got a lot of callers who want to join you, Daniel Levitin. Matt's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
With you.
Hello, Matt. You're there.
If you can. Hello?
Yes, Matt. You're on the air, my friend.
Hi. This is Matt Glazer calling.
Hi.
I have 200 things I wanted to ask and talk about here.
Great.
But I'll try to limit it to one thing. My mom was an opera singer.
Mm.
And she passed away from Alzheimer's disease a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of her life, she didn't know who I was, or she didn't know her own name. She didn't know where she was. But she could still sing the complete scores to 20 or 30 operas that she used to sing as a young woman. So I would go to visit her in the nursing home, and I would put on Don Giovanni. And she would say, da-da-da-da, and the orchestra would then play a dominant seventh chord, and then she'd sing the entire aria. And then I'd say, Mom, who am I? She said, I don't know, and who are you? So I did a little radio piece about this, but I've never gotten a kind of medical answer as to how it's possible that where all the most fundamental parts of her vocabulary were gone and understanding of the world, but she could still remember, let's say, 20 hours worth of music.
It's a fabulous story, and we're glad that she had that. Daniel Levitin, I don't know if you've looked at this angle, the Alzheimer's angle. Can you address it? I mean, Matt wonders, why did she still have all that when so much else was gone?
It's kind of a tragic story, Matt, but at the same time a beautiful and inspiring one. It's a bittersweet story there, I think. And we do know that with Alzheimer's, what you're looking at is a brain degeneration and the gradual death of brain cells. But many, many times we find that music, especially music that someone learned between the ages of, say, 8 and 14, is retained. This is because the music is learned during a period of rapid neural development when the synapses are going crazy trying to make new connections. Plus, you've got in the human between those ages raging hormones that are promoting the onset of puberty. And the combination of the hormones in the body and usually an emotional attachment to the music create a very strong and deep trace in the brain that's difficult to extinguish. It is one of the last things to go.
When we love a piece of music you've written, it reminds us of other music we've heard. It activates memory traces of emotional times in our lives. Your brain on music, all about those connections going way back. But here, this is music that Matt's mother would not have learned, presumably, in puberty. She's an opera singer. So this was probably, Matt, am I right, adult learning that she was bringing
back. Yeah, in her early 20s, probably, is when she committed this stuff to memory.
And did she have the melody still, as well as the lyrics at that
not
time?
Not the lyrics, just the melody.
Oh, just so the melody.
She would sing la la la. She would sing the entire score with just one syllable. She couldn't remember the words any longer, which she learned in Italian.
What could happen? What happens there is we found that there are when music gets into the brain. Tom was talking at the top of the hour about all the different processes this hunk of gray matter has to perform on music. Once music gets in the brain, the lyrics and the melody are separated out, and they're processed by different regions. So there could have been, unfortunately, an advanced cell death in the language and speech areas of the brain, and they went before the melody areas went, and so the melody was retained longer.
Matt, it's a wonderful picture with your mom having that, and we appreciate you sharing it with us. Let me take another call, if I may, from Orleans, Massachusetts. Kevin's on the line. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Yes. When I tune my guitar to concert pitch or A440, it doesn't quite sound right. The chords don't sound right. The intervals don't quite sound right. But then when I tune it up to like 443, 444, everything seems to ring, you know, and I really feel in tune and can sing along better. Have you ever heard of that?
What do you say, Daniel Ibsen?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things that might be going on there. One is that if you try to tune your guitar so that there are no beating between the strings, you're going to be tuning it to Pythagorean tuning, not equal temperament, and so it's not going to sound like a piano, for example, which is an equal-tempered instrument. By that I mean, for those that don't know, the piano tuning is actually a compromise because mathematically it doesn't work out that every note can be perfectly in tune. With a guitar, if you are tuning it just by ear, you're going to be tuning it in a way that's contrary to the piano, and if you're trying to play with a pianist or you are accustomed to listening to piano, it's going to sound a little bit out. Another thing that could be going on is the actual resonant frequencies of your particular guitar may be such that it sounds better when it's tuned up to 443. I've got a beautiful Martin Jumbo 12-string guitar, and it just doesn't sound right unless I tune it down a semitone. And I think that has to do with the bracing in the instrument, the physical construction of it. And when the strings are too tight, they pull on the wood and prevent it from vibrating at the natural frequencies it wants to.
Kevin, thanks very much for your call. Let's get a call from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Ed's on the line. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Yes. Every new caller brings up a new question.
Yeah.
I started out with two. Now I have 10.
Okay.
I'm currently reading a couple of books on bird song, and of course, as we talk more and more and get into the primitive brain and the reptilian connections here, there's even more connections. My first question is about learning, how much you find that music is a function of learning in the human as opposed to innate sensitivities.
And with that, do you mean music appreciation, the ability to appreciate it, learned or innate?
No, the learned response. It seems to me we can learn the connection between language and music if we know whether there is whether we are learning this from as a child. I mean, an infant learns to smile by looking at his mother and, and mimicking and learning to smile. And many birds. Some birds have to hear and learn their song. Some birds, as a matter of fact, even seem to be able to learn the song in the egg. Other birds seem to have it from the beginning.
That's a great angle of approach here. Daniel Levitin, what's your thought there?
Well, it is true that some birds have their song implanted in their brains. In fact, a colleague of mine at McGill, Evan Balaban, has done brain transplants between species of birds where he takes the auditory cortex from one embryo and implants it in the brain embryo of a different species to find out what song that hybrid bird or chimera will sing. And the bird tends to sing the song that was programmed in its brain rather than the song of the birds that it's raised with.
And what about Homo sapien on this front?
In the case of humans, infants typically go through a period of babbling, as you know, where they're trying out the different sounds that their mouths can make in preparation for language. And they also go through a period of musical babbling where they make up little melodies and rhythms, and they sing those sometimes with syllables like ba-ba-ba, sometimes just long pitch trajectories. If Ed was asking about the association that we learn between, say, minor chords and sadness, that absolutely is something that's learned and, as far as we know, is not intrinsic or hardwired. seems as though the infant is born with, as Chomsky has shown us, with the capacity to learn any language. The, you know, evolution and development don't know when an infant is born what language it's going to end up speaking. So it's given him a, or her a brain that's available to learn any language, that's primed to learn any of the languages of the world, and similarly any of the musics of the world.
Ed, you're terrific. I want to, and I thank you for your call. I want to, while I've got time before the next break, turn to a little experiment that Daniel Levitin has done with a Chopin Nocturne. Can you describe what you're up to here? And we'll listen to a bit of it. But first, tell us, what was your, what's your goal in this experiment?
In this experiment that we're doing in my lab, which is rather typical of the kind of things that we do in the music cognition realm, we wanted to understand what it is that gives an expressive performance its emotional touch. What is it that can move you to tears or just take the ground out from under you, that wonderful feeling that we can get from a piece of music that's ineffable. And we wanted to be able to manipulate some of the parameters of the performance to see what it was that was conveying the emotion. And moreover, we wanted to see how sensitive people were to subtle variations.
So let's look. Let's listen to the bass line nocturne, if we may, Chopin, the sort of full expressive version, and then you can walk us through, if you would, your experiment. Here's full expression. All right, so it engages our emotions right away in the way that classical music can. Take us on through your experiment here, Daniel Levitt.
So this is performed by Tom Plant, a pianist at McGill, and what he's doing is he's lengthening some notes and shortening others, playing some loud, some soft. And this isn't actually what's written in the score, but this is what, this is how a master musician treats a piece like this. What we did was we recorded this on our Yamaha disc clavier piano, which created a computer record of all of the movements that the pianist made. We then went into the computer and we stripped away all of the variability that there is in the timing and in the volume, creating a version that was rather robotic. And then we added in half of the emotion again, half of the variability in volume and in note lengths.
Let's listen to that, if we may. Half added back in. We don't have time before the break to hear all the steps in this, but you went all the way to a version that I want to begin to turn to here, where you actually stripped out everything, the kind of emotional cues, and then randomized notes with the computer. Let's listen to that on the Chopin Nocturne. Now, at this point, are we losing the emotional cues to our basal ganglia?
We are, because although this has all the complexity of the expressive version, the complexity is in all the wrong places. There's no coherence.
Speaking of which.
The lengthening and the shortening is done without rhyme or reason in that random version.
And so it makes me wonder then, when you look at neuroscience, I mean, typically we just say, well, that's a great pianist. They just know how to express it in a way that hits me. I'm not even thinking of the neuroscience. They understand how to communicate emotion. So is that art or is it science or are they the same?
Well, it's both. And I think an experiment like this can help to train aspiring pianists to become better pianists. We can quantify the types of expressive variation that are normally put into a piece. This is work, I should add, that's being done by students in my lab, Anna Tiravolis, who will be going to Harvard Grad School in the fall, and Anjali Batara, who's a doctoral student in
that's
my lab.
That's fantastic. Let's go out with a very different take on classical. Talk about different cues. Here's Woody Phillips playing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony on power tools. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
Later today, the history of...
Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about music and the brain with neuroscientist Daniel Levitin at McGill University. He joins us today from Vancouver, Canada. His new book is This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. And, oh, what a beautiful obsession it is. Questions for you. Do you know what makes you love what you love in music? Is it all about tickling our brains? I mean, what else? 800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-TALKS. Talk. Daniel Levitin writes some about music that flourishes, that works on our brain by operating within constraints. Here's the group Animaniacs singing Nations of the World.
And now, the Nations of the World, brought to you by Yakko Warner.
United States, Canada, Mexico, Panama, Haiti, Jamaica, Peru, Republic, Dominican, Cuba, Caribbean, Greenland, El Salvador, too, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Venezuela, Honduras, Guyana, and still Guatemala, Bolivia, then Argentina, and Ecuador, Chile, Brazil.
Okay, Professor, why have you got us plugged into Haiti, Jamaica, Peru?
I love this because I think that a lot of what we think of as creativity or genius in music is the instantiation of a musical idea done under very tight constraints. So here, the Animaniacs, Steven Spielberg's cartoon show, they set out to write a song that incorporated all the names of every nation in the world to the tune of the Mexican hat dance, you know, kind of a tour de force of creativity. And if you listen, not only do they get it to rhyme, but they do it sort of regionally. All the South American countries are together. Later in the song, all the European countries are together, then the African ones.
So we get it as a gimmick and as a joke, but as a neuroscientist, does our brain care about the constraint? Is that part of what it's recognizing and responding to in its appreciation, if it's there, of this song?
I think so, because I think, you know, when we look at a Van Gogh painting, part of us is thinking, you know, part of our brains are going, wow, that I don't know if I could do that. I don't know how he even thought of that. Mm-hmm. And yet it's familiar enough, the scene or the technique, that we have some anchor to it or some grounding to it. And I think that's the case here. You know, the constraint of the rock and roll song, the three chords that mm-hmm. we started out at the top of the hour, going from Jackie Brenson to Chuck Berry, the Beach Boys, and the Beatles, all working within a very tight structure. I think part of the appeal there is that we recognize that within a very tight constraint, each group of artists came up with something that was unique, a fresh take on an old theme.
And because our brains sort of are built to anticipate, they're taking pleasure in seeing how each sort of turns it a little bit. Paul's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm not a musician, but I can. And a great segue from your previous little discussion.
Yeah.
When I hear Wagner's Liebestod, myself and my brothers and sisters, we weep like a baby. I don't know what it is. You touched maybe a little bit on minor chord progression. Not that I really know exactly what that is, but it is a certain build up, and then release. But my question is, why do I cry like a baby and my wife doesn't, and other people don't? I feel so sorry for them.
That is a great question. Daniel Levitin, what do you say?
Well, there are some pieces of music that many, many people enjoy, and then there are other pieces of music that are more personal that are not universally enjoyed. And we all have our own favorites, or the pieces that can make us laugh or cry. Pieces that motivate us to get up out of bed in the morning. And they're personal because they're based on our own idiosyncratic listening history. The kind of music that you heard in the womb actually, as I explain in the book, became a template for what your musical preferences would be later in life.
But are some people simply more open to the emotionality of music, more affected by it than others?
I think that's certainly true, too. So there are two dimensions here. One is the particular pieces that might do it are going to be idiosyncratic and personal. And then there are going to be some people who are just more open to being moved by music as opposed to
and why
visual
there?
Art
is that a mechanical difference in the brain? Is it a psych? I mean, you're a professor in the departments of psychology, neuroscience, and music. So is it psychology at the level of whether or not we're open to being moved?
I think that we don't really know the answer to that. Part of the story is that 10% of the people, by our estimates, don't like music at all. It doesn't do anything for them, and they look at the rest of us and they think that we're wasting our money and our time. They just don't get it. Sort of like some people don't get bungee jumping. Why would anybody do that? And they look at music as an odd activity, but they've learned to not be too vocal about it because the 90% of us that get something out of music look at them as kind of weird.
Play it and weep, Paul, and thanks for your call. Let's get more music in our ears. There's a great cut, of course, from the Tito Puente song by Santana, Oye Como Va. Let's just listen for a minute. Okay, I can weep to it, Wagner, but this one gets me twitching every which way, and I've seen huge stadiums full of people doing it. What's going on here neuroscientifically?
This gives me chills, this solo. And, you know, what Carlos does so elegantly and so effortlessly is he makes the guitar speak like a voice. Nobody has that tone that Santana gets out of his guitar. And that particular passage we played, he's playing around with expectations and reward and violations. He plays a little passage, ba-da-da-da-ba-da, and then he plays it again in three or four different variations, adding little tiny nuances and trills and things, each time making it a little bit different. And then he hits one note that you least expect. And when he hits that, boy, that's when the chills come in for me.
It takes me back to what you read for us earlier, that these are computational systems in the brain, synchronized neural oscillators, sounds like science, but you hear it working here, with the pulse of the music and begin to predict what the next strong beat will be. And then when that expectation is met with something different, delight.
And Carlos, I think part of all of this is that we should recognize is that Carlos, as many musicians are, is a very emotional person and a very spiritual person. And when he's playing, he's totally into it and he's feeling these emotions. And we as listeners pick up on that. We recognize and we appreciate a sincerely felt emotion.
Let me take a call from Buffalo, New York. Doug's on the line. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
The Animaniacs geography song reminded me of Tom Lehrer once sent the periodic table to
right,
a song,
right.
Which, incidentally, thinking of it now, sounded a lot like Mozart or Haydn, which gets back to that you learn with that.
And the brain delighting as he went through, twisted everything into pretzels to make that work and feeling the constraint and the beauty of beating it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, my question to your guest, something that's come up, I teach a class on music interpretation. I play different performances of the same work for people, and then ask them what they think, what they find different, and what works for them and what does not work for them. And, you know, that's fine for anything up to the beginning of the 20th century, but after that you start getting into a tonal music, serial music, which kind of lasted for the century, and nobody wants to listen to that. And I've been thinking about that, and my postulation to the class, I wonder what your guest thinks, is that as a species, we have evolved appreciating a musical sound. By that I mean a pluck string, a hit piece of wood, a column of air that's made to vibrate, that vibrates in a very specific way. The distribution of the harmonics is something that is fixed. And those harmonics also correspond to our octave, the first
absolutely.
The fundamentals, the first note, The one octave up is the first harmonic, and so on and so forth.
In fact, the brain is organized in this fashion. The neurons are organized in columns sensitive to different pitches in order.
Well, then there's a scientific proof, I guess, of what I've been thinking about.
There you go. That's a brain teaser for me, Doug. I'm gonna have to dwell on it. But we feel the octave there, and I thank you for that. Let me get another call from Ames, Iowa. Ken, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Say, I was wondering if there could be any explanation for, when I was young, I noticed that I listened to pretty much a lot of the music that was being played in my house as I was being raised by my parents. And then as I was getting into adolescence, kind of my own personal interest in music kind of took me towards loud, ruckus of punk music in my early teens. And now I'm getting in my 30s, I realize that I'm really kind of listening to a lot of more down-tempo and a lot of things maybe that would even reach back again, perhaps, to that music that would be similar to what I've been raised to a little bit.
So is there a scientific explanation you wonder there?
I mean, just the connection between like how your brain matures throughout life and then maybe what connection that could have to, or what it can inform you on why you like the music you like at a given point in your life.
Daniel Levitin?
Well, this is a great issue, Kent, and I think what's happening is that we use music to self-medicate. We use music to motivate ourselves to clean the house or to exercise. We use music to calm ourselves after something stressful. And depending on what's going on in your life, you may choose different music to serve that role. I mean, you could even, in the 70s, a psychiatrist, before there was Prozac, a psychiatrist might have well said to somebody who was in a panic, take two Joni Mitchell songs and call me in the morning.
But what about the change in taste through life? Are you saying that, we face different stress levels and therefore we like different kinds of music? Give me my martini and something very cool, thanks.
I think that's part of it. And I think it's also that we use music for social functions. If you're out partying, you're going to want to listen to different music than you're going to want to listen sitting home alone with your martini.
Here's a cut, Kobayashi's song, The Game, that blends old and new. Let's listen.
There's so much more knowledge than what you learn in school. There's so much more knowledge than the bubble of two. It seems to still meet men and educated fool. Well, there's so much in their heads and so little they can use. SATs and all of these tests they abuse. If their minds ain't open, well, there's nothing we can do. If their minds ain't open, well, there's nothing we can do. If your mind ain't open, well, there's nothing I can do. If your mind ain't open, well, there's nothing I can do. Here's my turn.
So there comes the hip-hop turn, the strong music, the big beat. You've offered this one up to us, Daniel. Where does it take your thoughts?
I like this particular. I listened to some hip-hop, and I like this one in particular because, as you said, it mixes the traditional singing with the rap. And I also like the song because, ironically, it's talking about how one can go to school and learn a lot and really not know anything. You don't know enough about life necessarily with all that knowledge. Hip-hop's been around for 25 years now, and people have been saying it's just a fad, and they used to say that about rock music too. I think that people who aren't into hip-hop have to realize that it's here to stay, and there's quite a lot of rich variation there. And it's a wonderful marriage of African music and lyrics and a lot of fancy new pop sounds. Hip-hop records are produced with a very interesting palette of instruments and sounds.
But such a strong marriage there of beat and message. I mean, message, very important in hip-hop, almost standing in counterpoise to just straight rhetoric, oratory. Here you've got oratory plus the beat as a musical matter, as a scientific matter. Does that plant the message more deeply?
Absolutely. And I think, hip-hop has taken up the mantle of 60s protest songs in just the way that you said, Tom, about the lyric being the message. And when we set the message to music, it's doubly instantiated in the brain because the lyrics alone or, an oratory alone can be memorized, but the melody or the beat provides certain constraints that help you to remember. We find in studies of people that seem to have prodigious memory for facts or for stories that when that information is set to music, it's or to at least to a rhythm, it's much more easily remembered. As you and your listeners probably know, the Old Testament itself was originally set to music, and that's how it was transmitted orally before it was ever written down.
I'm learning every second. Let me get another quick call. David's calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, David, you're on the air. Hello, David, are you there, my friend? It's like David is off in another direction. Let's go to Aiken, South Carolina, and Josh. Hi, Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious if there's been done any research or studies as to what happens in the brain when the inner ear is activated and a melody is stuck in your head and you're not actually listening to music, but your musical imagination or memory is sort of producing the music in your own head.
And won't let it go, Black Eyed Peas or whatever it might be that day. What about the song that's stuck in our heads, Daniel? Give us the neuroscience in a minute or less.
Well, what's happening there is our brains essentially get stuck in a short circuit or a loop, and it's usually with a song that's relatively simple, catchy, and we could talk for a long time about what makes something catchy, but it tends to happen more often in people who are anxious about something. There are two ways to get rid of that song in your head. One is to take Prozac or Valium or Ativan if it's really, really bad. Second way is to do what Neil Young said that he did. He became a songwriter in order to get those songs out of his head
right,
because
Sam.
He wasn't hearing other people's. He was hearing new melodies. In fact, there's a third way to get rid of him, and that is to find an equally annoying but different song and put that in its place.
Well, a substitution works in so many fields. I have to ask you a last question and a short one here. Do you like music more or less, Mr. Former Record Producer, now that you're a neuroscientist?
I think I like it more because I'm not trying as hard to find the next hit to sign to Columbia Records. I can just enjoy it for what it is.
Well, it's been a great tour today, and we're really grateful for it. We thank you for your work there and your time. And the book, Daniel Levitin, thanks very much for joining us.
I think you're going to end with one of my favorite songs of all time, favorite recordings by Frank.
I'm right there with you on that. My basal ganglia always go for this one. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. He's associate professor in the departments of psychology, neuroscience, and music at McGill University. We'll go out with Frank, Sinatra, Old Blue Eyes, Mac the Knife. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone perhaps perchance be Mac the Knife? From a tugboat on the river going slow, a cement bag, it is dropping down. Yeah, the cement just for the weight, dear. You can make a large bet Mac Heath is back in town. My man Louis Miller, he split the scene, babe. After drawing out all the breath from his stash.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point comes from the listeners.